Morning. Pretty large class for homological algebra. So, I'm not quite sure yet how to time the course. In other words, I can only lecture once a week, so there's a 3-hour block, but I don't want to torture you and lecture for 3 hours in a row, so maybe we'll take a break after an hour and a half or so, and then can have some discussion. So quite in general, my plan is to structure it in such a way that I'll deal with some theory in the first 1.5 to 2 hours, and then use the rest of the time to deal with some significant examples. Will not necessarily be the case today, because one has to build up a certain amount of theory and terminology before one can talk about examples in a meaningful way. But I thought it might be useful, even though it will be very sketchy, to try to position what I would call modern homological algebra in the overall picture, and also to mention some buzzwords that are at the sort of at the end of the tunnel, when once we have the theory well understood, what would be the next things one could do from here. So we'll be quite messy in large diagrams, so let me try to start here. So one could say sort of the most basic algebraic theory is clearly linear algebra. And, of course, nobody thinks twice really about this, because it's a pretty basic and simple theory. However, I think it is worthwhile to remember a few things about the history. So clearly, I think everybody would agree that Descartes was sort of the founder or discoverer of linear algebra. However, one has to keep in mind that he certainly did not think about vector spaces. He thought about coordinates. And it took a long, long time to set up linear algebra in an abstract way as it is taught now in any first-year linear algebra course. I'll come back to this in a second, but I will just say the second, initially not directly related, basic theory was, of course, Galois theory. And so this is roughly 1820. I never remember what the year Galois died. And both together in the 19th century led really to a serious study of algebra. And let me just mention a few things here. We had associative algebra. These were the so-called hypercomplex systems, as algebras were originally called. And they were largely motivated initially by things like Hamilton's discovery of the quaternions, where one tried to understand whether some other spectacular structure could be out there that we had just missed, such as the quaternions turned out to be the right tool to study rotations in three space. Maybe there was much more to be had. This was sort of one thing, and I would think that this was motivated from linear algebra, but it was also motivated from Galois theory, and that came quite a bit later. But for example, the theory of the Brouwer group and simple central algebras, study of simple central algebras that arose out of Galois theory. One could, of course, argue that commutative algebra is a subset of associative algebra, but historically, this is not quite how it developed, because commutative algebra really arose out of number theory. And to some extent, one was trying to transplant what one understood for vector spaces for finite abelian groups, or more generally for representation of rings of algebraic integers. And so there was, again, a heavy influence from the Galois theory, from the linear algebra, and I'll just put down some names. So Dedekind, I think, was the first one who really tried to get at the abstract nature of the thing, and then, of course, one needs to mention Kronecker. And finally, Eminerta. And on the other hand, of course, Galois theory led to abstract group theory on one hand, and to the theory, and geometry led to the theory of Lie groups or Lie algebras. And we have first the finite groups, and there's the work of Frobenius, Schur, and Brouwer around the turn of the 20th century, just slightly before that. And then, of course, we have the continuous groups and the connection with the Lie algebras, and this is the work of Sophus Lie and Felix Klein, and, of course, many, many others. Then, the theory of groups, Lie algebras, and to some extent commutative algebra all entered into the study of what we call nowadays algebraic topology. And now we are roughly in the 1920s, 1930s. And from our point of view, it is really here in the algebraic topology that sort of homological algebra arises for the first time, and the questions that are studied arise here. And the reason is, from my point of view, that two relatively different concepts were noted to have a lot in common. Namely, one was the theory of topological spaces and continuous maps, or differentiable maps, if you were to study differentiable manifolds. And on the other hand, it was already known that these algebraic structures came in here in a heavy way. So there's a theory of the fundamental group. There's a theory of homology or cohomology, which one might, of course, argue goes actually back to Euler, at least in its rudimentary form. And so, from our point of view, the sort of the crucial notion which came from algebraic topology was that of functoriality or naturality. In other words, that if you could ask yourself, if you have a continuous map between two spaces, you have, say, a fundamental group for these two spaces, what does this map do to the corresponding fundamental groups? So I want to say that what I wrote down so far is sort of the concrete classical algebraic theory. And one of the things which I really found when I was around getting my thesis, I had a reason to read Hermann Weyl's book on classical groups. And if you do ever do that and you look at the introduction, then he goes on for several pages about the concept of a vector space. And I mean, this book was written in 1935-37, and having grown up in the abstract tradition, I was wondering, why was he doing that? I mean, all this is, of course, obvious, right? What he describes there, and it goes on in a lot of detail. And he states, more or less himself, that he wants that physicists accept the idea of a vector space. And that's why he takes the time to explain it. So one has to realize that sort of the abstract algebra, the way we think about it today, only arose at around the 1930s. And that was indeed sort of the landmark publication there is, of course, van der Weyden's treatment of algebra, his two volumes of Modern Algebra, which were sort of the first attempt to write down in a concise way what had gone on for the 50 years prior. And it was about the same time that, as I said, Hermann Weyl goes to great lengths to convince the reader that the abstract notion of a vector space is a reasonable context. And Maurice Auslander, who's one of the major figures in homological algebra, he told me once that in the 1950s, Emil Artin would refuse to talk about quotient groups. He would always talk about congruence classes because he felt that the notion of a quotient group was too complicated. He did not want to scare away his audience. So it's only 60, 70 years ago, or even 50 years, that things started to change. Now, algebraic topology essentially led to what we would nowadays call classical homological algebra. And so classical homological algebra, I would think, is about the time from the 1930s to 1956. And again, there is one book that captures very well what was the state of the art at the time, and that's one of the reasons why I put 1956 there, and that is Kartan Eilenberg's book on homological algebra, which appeared in that year. But in that year, also a few other things happened, and I'll come to this in a second. Now, as I said, homological algebra arose out of the desire to find a framework which would combine sort of algebra and topology, and even though clearly it has relations to the commutative algebra, associative algebra, and groups, these connections were relatively tenuous for quite a while. Although in Kartan Eilenberg's group, of course, one book one finds a chapter on the cohomology of groups. Then, and this is where sort of one amazing phenomenon happens, so classical homological algebra, it's probably not correct to say it gave rise to, but it certainly greatly influenced the discovery and development of category theory. Now, category theory, as we understand it now, appears in the literature for the first time in 1942 in a paper by Eilenberg MacLean. Where they try to codify these notions of functoriality and naturality. Now, the tragic thing is that Bourbaki started working in 1939, so just a few years earlier. And so, one consequence of this is that they missed out completely on category theory. Now, the other aspect of this is that category theory was developed in Chicago, and Bourbaki was in France. And in those days, we didn't have the internet, and things didn't spread quite as rapidly as they do now. So what happened was that Bourbaki's attempt to codify abstract algebra used rather artificial concepts. We looked talking about species and all sorts of things. So if you read the elements of set theory, the first, which was supposed to be the first volume of Bourbaki, nowadays you think, how could they have missed this so blatantly? And that's all one of the reasons why I think what Bourbaki sort of tethered out, because nobody really had the guts to go back and rewrite the whole thing using category theory. Now, one of the things is that category theory in itself, for a while, was considered just abstract nonsense. And it's, many people still think of it this way. And of course, as is often the case with new theories, there are lots of people who will grind out all the details and whether lemma 3.25 can be proven with a slightly weaker assumption. And so there was a lot of stuff done which is of dubious importance. However, the big breakthrough of category theory, and I'll put sort of algebraic geometry here at the side. So this is algebraic geometry roughly in the mid-1950s when it was in dire straits. There was a very strong tradition of algebraic geometry in the 19th century, both in Germany and in Italy. In Germany, people went, the fashion went more towards algebra. In Italy, geometry stayed very strong, and people had extremely good intuition, but the intuition jumped ahead of the reality, and it turned out that a lot of the results, which were intuitively true, were simply false. And people didn't understand for quite a while why they were false. Why was the intuition not working in certain cases? And it was acknowledged that simply the technical tools were not available to really study the kind of questions one wanted to. So it's basically a lot of classification theorems which were the most spectacular failures in those, especially in the early 20th century. And then, again, André Weil, who is one of the founders, if not the motor behind Bourbaki, set out to rewrite algebraic geometry. And today we would say, in his book on Foundations of Algebraic Geometry, what he tried to do is to write algebraic geometry as a theory of functors. But he wasn't familiar with the language, and so it all looked somewhat artificial and did not really go very far, except that it pushed Alexander Grothendieck to completely rethink how to do algebraic geometry. And this gave the major input into category theory and led eventually to what we now call modern homological algebra. And this is really what I want to concentrate on. And so this was related to, just to start some buzzwords, to the theory of schemes and sheaves, and the need to put this into a proper framework. I also want to mention, and this is where 1956 comes in the second time, in 1956, Alexandre Grothendieck published his fundamental so-called Tohoku paper, because it's in the Tohoku journal, on abelian categories. And this is also, again, one can see so how often things sort of shift from one moment to the next. For example, in the book by Carter and Eilenberg, which was published in 1956, but certainly written over at least the five previous years, if not a decade, I'm not familiar with that aspect, but it contains an appendix by David Buxbaum on exact categories. And this appendix was a slightly... I'm just about to tell you this story. So he wrote then a separate paper, I believe in the Transactions of the AMF, which is, I think, the precursor of this appendix, so there's the journal version of it. And Henri Cartan wrote the review for it. And it's sort of one of the most amazing things. The review says the author tries to set up the theory of exact categories. However, by now we know that the right notion is that of an abelian category, and then the rest of the review goes on to describe what Grothendieck did but hadn't published at that time. So, and Buxbaum was very close, but he forgot one action, which he didn't consider to be so important, which the only difference, essentially, in the setup between what Buxbaum did and what Grothendieck did. Actually, I can tell at this point a nice anecdote of my own. I was an assistant professor in Brandeis in the early 80s, and Buchweitz and Buxbaum, so Buxbaum was in Brandeis too, so we had our mailboxes next to each other. And one day I come to the department, pick out my mail, and there is a letter from somewhere in Ethiopia. And I thought, wow. So I open it, and somebody writes, I recently learned, so this is, I'm not that old, so this is in the early 80s, right? I recently learned that you developed the theory of abelian categories. I have found the same, and so I thought, well, that's not for me, so I turned it around, and of course it was addressed to Buxbaum, not to me, it just had slipped into the wrong mailbox. And so he was asking whether there had been any further work in this direction. No, just tells you how isolated some people are and still do good mathematics, right? Because he had apparently discovered this all by himself and was not at all familiar with the intervening 25 years. So if you get a chance, look at MathSciNet with David Buxbaum, 1956, Henri Cartan's review, it's really amazing. Now, of course, this is the black box, as I said, the modern homological algebra I'm trying to go to explore. But now comes sort of the outlook, and certainly not be able to discuss any of these features in detail. But I wanted to at least say how this theory feeds back then to its sources. So some people would argue, and this was nowadays it's perhaps no longer such a big deal, but certainly 20 years ago it was, where people were saying, well, this is pure Buberkism, right? You make things more and more and more abstract, and where's the beef, right? Where's the content? Now, as it turned out, there's a lot of content, and I'll just try to say a few things, and I've tried to do it somewhat in parallel to what I did there. So the relations to associative algebra, there are certainly two things. On the one thing, there's what's called tilting theory. Again, tilting theory was something which was sort of discovered ad hoc in the 1970s by Gelfand and Ponomariov, in trying to understand the theorem of Gabriel about quiver representations. It was also considered to be somewhat, well, special and combinatorial in nature and so on. But lo and behold, now you even hear algebraic geometers talking about tilting theory. Things go backwards with what some people call derived Morita equivalence. Because Morita equivalence is really some classical associative algebra, and it was tried to see what this yields in the context of homological algebra, and these are the results mainly by Jeremy Rickard. And these results opened up a whole can of worms which led to homological understanding of the Fourier-Mukai transform. Well, I'll come to this in a second. The other outgrowth of modern homological algebra in concrete terms is certainly the theory of quantum groups. And if you want to get a feel for this, I would suggest you read Greenfeld's ICM talk in Berkeley in 1986. And something which I think everybody, or a lot of people, were aware of in those days, but he, to my knowledge, was the first one to put it on paper and just lay it out there. You see, if we go back to the classical picture, then originally algebra and geometry were two different things. Geometry looked at concrete spaces and their features, whereas algebra looked at sort of the arithmetic or slightly more complicated versions of it. And it is really algebraic geometry, and Grothendieck, who brought these two things together by saying what you really should do is you should understand a space through the ring of functions that is defined on it. And of course, this was supported by the Gelfand-Neimark theorem, which classified sort of commutative C-star algebras in terms of geometry. And the one flaw in this concept was that many people had tried to repeat Grothendieck's success in dealing with algebraic geometry by defining some really weird spaces called schemes, plus the functions on them, which are collected into what's called a sheaf. However, this did not go really anywhere in the non-commutative world. Whatever people tried turned out to be not sufficient. You could only do very limited things, and there was no generality whatsoever. Well, Greenfeld, in his talk at the ICM, he turned the whole thing around and said, okay, we have no spaces for non-commutative rings, so let's just say that the non-commutative rings are the functions on some space. We don't know what the space is. We don't care. It might not be a space in a physical world, but just let's turn this thing around, and whenever we talk about spaces, we simply think of the dual situation of algebra. Now, this might not mean too much to you, but it is the one thing which, for example, allows it to think about quantum groups as actual groups, which they are not. They are not functions on any group. The other related outgrowth of modern homological algebra, and I'll just jump, I think I should mention this, is the Riemann-Hilbert correspondence. Which solved one of the outstanding problems from Hilbert's list, and sort of is connected with what is called perverse sheaves. But the modern version of it is called crystals or crystal bases, and quite recently the notions of trivial varieties, and also representation theory of the symmetric group. And so all this, if you want, is sort of the influence on back from modern homological algebra to the representation theory of Lie algebras, really. And there's a very intriguing connection just very recently between these two ends, and it's also, it would not be possible without the insight of modern homological algebra, and this is the so-called theory of cluster algebras. So cluster algebras arose maybe it's already a decade that they first were introduced. They look awfully complicated. And you ask yourself, why would anyone want to deal with these guys? But it has become clear, and there's a real explosion over the last 3-4 years, that these concept of cluster algebras explains a whole lot of things. For example, it does explain fully what was really going on in the early 70s when Bernstein-Gelfand-Ponomariov introduced the tilting theory. It is through the cluster algebras nowadays that we can put it all together and say, aha, this is what it is. It's just different faces of the same thing. And this is very much in flux. I think most of the papers, relevant papers of cluster algebras, you can find on the preprint server, but they are not yet published. The other intriguing thing which we do not sufficiently understand yet, so-called Ringle-Hall algebras, which encode geometry in algebra in a totally new way. And for example, Misha Kapranov had some idea on how to generalize this. One of the things is the Ringle-Hall algebras only work over finite fields so far, and it is not clear at all what is sort of the real object that we are looking at. Can you make this work in the context, say, of complex geometry? What should be the right substitute? Now, let's go even. So these are things that at least are already in paper, but now we'll come to some things where a lot of it is still speculation. And then we have over here sort of the influence on algebraic geometry. And I just want to mention some buzzwords. So we have the theory of moduli stacks. And their representations. Desingularization. Which still, it's understood in the complex domain in characteristic 0, but in characteristic P, we have no idea yet still whether it is always possible and how it would look like, how you would do it. The intriguing thing is that the modern homological algebra, this philosophy of just abandoning the spaces, well, if you do that, then you have, for example, to explain what would be the algebraic meaning of desingularization. So if you didn't have a space where you can physically see there's a singularity that you somehow want to smooth out, what does it mean if you only know about the functions? And that leads to the theory of non-commutative desingularization, which is still in its infancy, but one of the spectacular successes was the so-called Mackay correspondence some 2 to 4 years ago. So there's this paper by Bridgeland, King, and Reed, in the Journal of the AMS in 2002, which sort of does the baby case. This is not trying to put down the results, but it sort of it should be the tip of the iceberg. But nobody really knows what the shape of the iceberg underneath. And people are just trying now to come up with the right framework. And there are people like Michel van den Berg. And Paul Smith, Zhang, Artin, Rogalski, and a lot of others try to understand what it all could mean and whether there's any chance of trying to prove desingularization for singularities in the non-commutative setup. But, by the way, in a lot of cases, this turns out to be much easier than what we used to do classically in the commutative world. Then we have the, clearly, and that's, I guess, why some of you are here, the relations to the physics and geometry, and as I'm not an expert on it, I will shut up on this. So there's certainly string theory, but there's also mirror symmetry. And so I wanted to sort of here at the bottom, and I am almost at the bottom, say sort of the big themes that certainly will need a lot of the machinery of modern homological algebra. So on the far side, there's a non-commutative desingularization of algebraic spaces. Then, of course, here we have the homological mirror conjecture. And I wanted to say that modern homological algebra also harks back to the very classical topic of Galois theory. And this is also very recent. And of course, it is sort of amazing that the fundamental theorem of Galois theory was proven by Galois in about 1820, and we still don't understand it, almost 200 years later. And the big question, and this is, there's the so-called theory of almost modules, which tries to provide a framework for infinite-dimensional Galois representations. So this is relatively recent work by Faltings and Gaber. And of course, what the big problem here is to try to understand the structure, say, of the Galois group of Q bar over Q. A huge group about which we know only very, very little. And once we know this, once we know that, and once we know this, I think then we get to the Holy Grail, and that is to understand the theory of motives. Sort of the motives theory, ideally the theory of motives should capture the whole essence of algebraic geometry, should strip it of all the things you do not need to know. But it will need more or less solution of these three things first, I believe, before we really can get there. On the other side, and I'll run out of space, so maybe wrap it around to that blackboard, or let me just put it down here. So these two things, the Lie algebras and the Galois theory, come together in what's called the Langlands correspondence. And both in its algebraic and geometric form, where the geometric form is almost finished, but the algebraic form is far from being understood. And that involves all the Galois theory and also the Riemann-Hilbert correspondence over there. And so one of the things which is at the moment somewhat isolated, but it are the applications of modern homological algebra to knot theory. And what's what Kovanov calls is categorification. And at least sort of the same things in this, and I'm not an expert here nor here, so as an outsider I can at least see that the same items appear here and here. But what is the bridge between the two? That's not clear at all. Okay, so this is what I thought I would try to indicate. I want to go back and make one remark here. For example, category theory, as I said, initially, especially in the mid-60s and the 70s, was considered to be really just abstract nonsense. Why would anyone care? However, there were some successes which for a while were not really acknowledged. So for example, maybe I'll just put it in a box here, understanding category theory led to a structure theory of Artinian algebras, And so this is basically the observation by Gabriel, Pierre Gabriel, starting in 1970-ish, 70-72, and which still keeps people busy, and that's sort of what's called the quiver representations. And at the time, it took a long time until people really appreciated this relatively trivial result. Something everybody could have thought of that. But it was a direct application of category theory to a classical subject, to associative algebras. And one of the things I want to do, but certainly not today, is to give at least an outline of what Gabriel's theorem is actually saying. Because I think this is part of what every mathematically educated person should know and understand what it is actually about. There's another reason why I say that. Because earlier in his French thesis, which was sort of Gabriel was, I think, he and Grothendieck didn't get along too well. I mean, Grothendieck was a big guy and Gabriel always sort of was fighting. But he was much more concrete than Grothendieck, and that hurt at the time. Because people were more inclined to listen to the big ideas instead of looking at the really concrete stuff. So the interesting thing is that Gabriel, in his thesis, which is in the Bulletin of the Société Mathématique de France in late 60s or mid-60s, he more or less anticipated the theory of the almost modules. It's in his thesis. But people didn't pay any attention. It just came back in three different guises over the last 5 years. Quillen developed a theory of, well, one could call modules over rings without identity. It's another thing where you think, well, why would anyone care? Well, the reason is, of course, if you do operator algebras, then, for example, you want to think of infinite matrices, let's say, which are row and column finite. So certainly you can multiply these gadgets, but there is no unit element anymore. And so you would like to understand the representation theory. And the fundamental observation is that if you try to do it the naive way, you get nowhere. So you have to have a new idea. Well, Quillen had that new idea. It isn't published. It's referenced in a book on categorical algebra, and if you search on the internet, then you will see there is an abstract by Quillen or a colloquium talk he gave at the University of Florida a few years back, which in the abstract pretty much lays out what this is all about. Very nice to read. So this was Quillen coming on it from one side, from the C star algebras, Faltings and Gabber coming from it from the Galois representation side. And by the way, there is a recent Springer lecture notes by Gabber and Romero, 250-page Springer lecture note, which tries to generalize everything to these almost modules. Let me know when you reach the last page. And then another surprising area where the same thing comes up, and that's the work of Paul Roberts, is in the connection with what's called some of the standard conjectures in commutative algebra. These are questions about polynomial rings. So you don't think that you would really need some big machinery trying to answer these questions, but there was two or three years ago, Heitman in Texas established one of these standard conjectures in commutative algebra for rings of dimension 3. His proof is bare hands, pages and pages and pages of calculations. And so Paul Roberts, who is more inclined on the abstract side, I think he was a reviewer for the paper, and he said that for months he didn't understand what was going on. And then he tried to rephrase it in his own words, and lo and behold, what comes out is that the proof given by Heitman it can be seen as an application of the theory of almost modules. So, C star algebras, Galois representations, commutative algebra, they all come together again and use the same tools from the sort of forefront of homological algebra. I'm trying to get there eventually, but I won't make any promises. Okay, so after all this grand scheme, so what I would, my main objective here was to show you that once you have endured the technicalities and the intricacies of the modern homological algebra, the sky is the limit. There are lots of questions you can try your teeth on. Okay, so now what are we really talking about here? Now I assume that everybody here is essentially familiar with a lot of algebra. You certainly, everybody here has had a course in group theory, probably certainly linear algebra, rings and modules to some extent. And so you will all be aware that all these mathematical theories have certain things in common. You specify certain properties, and then you look at maps between similar gadgets. And by the way, of course, homological just means literally looking the same. Right? So it's the algebra of things that look the same. Now, what is this? Well, this is, of course, nothing very deep. But what is the basic idea? So let's start with category theory. So what's the basic idea about category theory? The basic idea is that the actual objects, that is the groups, the Lie algebras, the rings, the spaces, are not really what we should be interested in. What we should be interested in is the relations between them. So in other words, the shift when coming up with category theory was to put the individual objects and incarnations of the theory into the background and to emphasize the relations, that is, the study of the morphisms. Sounds quite abstract, so I'll give you quickly the definition of a category, and then I'll go back and show you that indeed the objects disappear, like magic. So here's sort of the definition. So a category C consists of, now, this is the Achilles heel of category theory, that already the first term is not defined. A collection ob C called the objects of C. So what is this funny phrase here? Well, categories should be thought of, at least at one level, as catch-alls. You want to talk about the category of all sets. Well, there's no way that all sets form a set, right? As Bertrand Russell so convincingly argued. So, if you want to talk about the category of all sets, well, then all sets taken together is not a well-defined thing. So that's where the logicians come in. So if you want to understand what is a possible definition of a collection, you need to ask a logician. Now, we'll come back to this, because often it doesn't matter, because many results we are going to talk about are local in nature. That is, you take a finite number of gadgets and perform something on them. No question that you can do that. But there are a few instances where you would like to talk about results that apply sort of to the whole universe. And then you have to make sure that you do not enter a vicious circle. Now, there are various proposals how to go around it. Grothendieck's proposal was the creation of what is called a universe. So So universe is a particular model of set theory. It has only one big disadvantage. There are only two universes known, the empty set and the natural numbers. There is no universe. One cannot prove the existence of a universe which contains a non-denumerable set, because the axiom required for it is so strong, it requires, among other things, the existence of a strongly inaccessible cardinal number that we can't even prove whether this is consistent with the usual set theory. So there are some logic and set theoretical problems if you try to make this precise. However, as I said, this will not be our major concern. It is just to highlight it right now so that we have seen that. Secondly, second piece of a category is a collection. Here it comes again, this ominous word, of disjoint sets. And this is crucial, that now we really enter familiar territory. And these sets are called CXY for each ordered pair X, Y of objects from C. And often, you see, because each of these is a set, so it makes sense to talk about elements and so on. Often, we write an element F in CXY, so is written as an arrow, so like this or like that. So we think of these as being the maps of our theory. But there have been no, X and Y are not necessarily sets, nor do they have anything to do with sets, but we think of these collection, these individual sets as the morphisms from X to Y. And in this vein, what is the most basic thing we want to be able to do with these guys? Well, we want to be able to compose them. So we require that there are maps, which I write like as composition, which go from CYX cross CZY to CZX. And so if you have a pair, remember, these are sets, so is the Cartesian product. So if you have a morphism F here and a morphism G here, then you can talk about the composition. You see, that's where this diagram notation comes in handy. So what are we saying? We are saying we have a map from Z to Y, which is G. We have a morphism from Y to X, which is F. And all we require is that then there is something which can stand in for the composition. And, of course, and so this for each, we have one such map for each ordered triple of objects from C. So for each ordered triple X, Y, Z from the objects of C. So, and here there are two conditions. So subject, these data are subject to the following conditions. No, I can't. Well, what's the least thing you should have if you have a theory? Well, whatever your structure is, the identity map should always be a homomorphism. Otherwise, something's wrong with your theory. So the first thing is we require identity morphisms. Hmm. reminds me of a story. A friend of mine, his son, who also studied mathematics, and he, my friend always got upset about the fact that in second year, then they have to have some exam in basic algebra, that his son considered this such an important fact that the identity homomorphism of a group is an isomorphism, well, the identity map on a group is an isomorphism of groups, right? So they are important, but let's not overdo it. So for each object X and C, there is a morphism called the identity on X from X to X. Such that for every morphism F from X to Y, we have that F composed with the identity on X equals F equals the identity on Y composed with F. Right? So if you take a map. Interesting remark, yeah. Probably true. Yeah. Second condition is associativity. Of composition. So in other words, we want at least that the composition of morphism satisfies associativity, if nothing else. So how do we say that? So this is part of the curse of category theory, that something which is obvious to state takes a while to write down. So maybe I'll try some shorthand. So if you have a diagram like this, you have a morphism H, morphism G, and a morphism F. Then you can form, because of the given composition, you can form GH, you can also form FG, and you can form the whole thing. So in this diagram, all compositions from U to X are equal, i.e., we have that F round G composed with H equals F composed with G round H. Now, of course, you would have to say for all morphisms F, G, H, etc. So that's it. These are the axioms. Now, because some of it is rather technical, so one uses a lot of abuse of notation. And one piece I will explain in a minute where it comes from. So when often I, so shortcuts. We simply write X and C instead of X is an object from C. We also simply write F from X to Y in C instead of saying F is in C of X, Y, which is a morphism set in C. A remark on the requirement over here, where we ask that these morphism sets are disjoint. This is, of course, not a big deal, because if there aren't, you can always artificially make them disjoint. But the consequence of this is, of course, so axiom two, disjoint morphism sets, is just meant to guarantee that each morphism has a unique source or domain and target. Or, and this is another piece of this sort of category speak, codomain. Right? Because so if a morphism were to appear in two different such sets, then it wouldn't be clear from where to where it's going, and the disjointment is just going to meant to guarantee this. Three, identities are unique. In other words, there cannot be two identity maps on any given object. Proof left to the reader. Fourth, we often write, and this is my, I personally prefer that, to write hom c from x to y instead of c of x and y. Because I really like to think of these morphisms as being the homomorphism of some kind of structure, even if I don't understand what the structure is. And so one also uses, in the same vein, the endomorphisms of some object x is, of course, just the morphisms from x to itself. And this is an associative monoid. In other words, you have a composition on it, you have an identity element, and it is associative. Okay. So here, first come the things that create the problem with the set theory, but I just list them so that we have names for it. And I think most of it that needs no explanation. So clearly we have the category of sets. And usually I write these big categories are, well, have some special font associated to them. It's like fracture, but that I can't do so well on a blackboard, so I won't try. So this is, of course, just the objects are sets, and the morphisms are just the usual maps between sets, and clearly this, the axioms are satisfied. Then we have the category of groups, which I also write as GPS. It has nothing to do with global positioning system, just to shorthand. And I think I leave it to you to fill in what comes there. More important is the category of abelian groups, because this will keep us busy for a while. And you can make up your own. For example, you can define Lie to be the category of Lie algebras with homomorphisms of such things. I want, because I will use some of these to illustrate some phenomena in a moment. So rings, well, it's a category of associative rings with unit and unit-preserving ring homomorphism, which are also called unital ring homomorphisms. And this is a pun due to Nathan Jacobson. So what do you call rings without an identity? I call it rungs, right? Rings minus the I. So these are associative rings, not necessarily with identity. And so then it makes also no sense to require that if even if a unit is there, that it is preserved. So here you have just homomorphisms that preserve addition and multiplication, but nothing else necessarily. And then there are other things like commutative rings. Topological spaces, topological groups, etc. I want to mention one category, even if it doesn't probably mean too much if you have never seen it before. But just here, in these big categories, the point is that each object has a set underlying. And as these things go, I mean, it takes a while to let go of old friends, right? So for example, when sheaf theory was developed, the category of sheaves is one example. So let's say we have X as a topological space, and you take sheaves on X, so the category of sheaves. We'll come back to this example later, but just to indicate that a sheaf is something local. Think of a topological space and the continuous functions. Well, why should you only consider all the globally defined continuous functions? You might be content and might be much more useful to consider all of them, even if they are only defined somewhere on an open set. So you try to do that. And then, of course, there are some relations. If you have an intersection of two open sets, you can restrict your functions, and you may or may not get the same function on the intersection. So there is no natural space attached to a sheaf, and people have abandoned this idea that there should be a space attached to it. However, if you look at the early works on sheaf theory, for example, Goodman's book on Théorie des faisceaux et topologie algébrique, he goes through a great rigmarole to assign what was called the étale space of a sheaf. If you look at this, you say, why would you do this? I mean, what's the use of this? Well, the only use, historically speaking, was that people wanted some underlying set, not some collection of things that you had to bundle together into a sheaf to make it some object. So the thinking that objects and sets have not necessarily anything to do with it was quite a remarkable process. Now, I leave it to you to extend this list. And so these are the kind of meta-categories where the objects themselves certainly do not form a set. I do not want to overemphasize this and to give the impression that there is something wrong with category theory. The situation is more like this. Does it make sense to talk about all groups with two elements? For example, which would be the same as sets, right? So, there is no such thing as all groups with two elements. However, we all know what a group with two elements is. So it is more this kind of dichotomy that sometimes, if one isn't careful, can lead to problems. So, to account for this, well, let's see whether we can play it safe. And yes, of course we can, and that's the concept of small categories. And the definition is very simple. A category C is small if the objects of C form a set. And so the basic philosophy behind the theory of universes is that if you have a large category, but you go further out in the galaxy, then you look at this universe and it is still a set. So in other words, the basic axiom there is whatever you have, you can put it as a set into something. Right? And if you make sure, so you have this axiom that every universe is an element in another one. And so whenever you perform your constructions, if you go beyond normal set theory, that is, you're forced to leave your universe, you just make sure that you somewhere in this tower you get into a new one. So it's sort of this telescope principle which is behind the theory of universes. Now, unfortunately, as I said, there are only two known universes, and the existence of these things is about as dubious as anything else. However, so small categories, I want to give you two, maybe three, sort of basic examples, and then revisit the notion of a small category and show you that this is just really an algebraic object. So here are some examples of small categories. So the first one, and we look at very small ones, namely, if you have a directed graph, then you can view it as a category, so-called path category. Namely, you consider the vertices to be the objects, and now perhaps you would like to say, well, let's consider the arrows as morphisms. However, that wouldn't work because you need composition. So what you do is, so concatenations, so the paths, which are the concatenations of arrows, these correspond to the morphisms. So very important subclass of this is what's called posets. So posets are partially ordered set. Which means that you have a set S together with a binary relation on it, and this relation satisfies that S is smaller or equal than S. And if S is smaller or equal than T, is smaller or equal, and T is smaller or equal than U, then S is smaller or equal than U. So you have what's called reflexivity and transitivity, but not necessarily not necessarily anti-symmetry. So, it's pre-ordered sets. Sorry. Because what you also don't have is that if S small or equal to T, T small or equal to S, and then T is equal to S. Don't require this. Now, if you look at the path category for this, then what is a distinguishing feature of a category assigned to a post set? So now you think of the vertices as the object and of the paths as the morphisms. And I tell you that if given a category, a small category, I can tell you whether it comes from a poset or not, because it has one identifying feature. What is this feature? That's not what I had in mind. Maybe I didn't explain it. So here's a lemma. Posets, the same thing as small categories, with the property that each with each hum set having at most one element. So these are the small categories that are really small in the sense that there are very few morphisms. Between any two objects, there is at most one morphism. And when is there a morphism? Well, when these two objects are comparable in the given order, and there's none if not. And so the existence of the identity is covered here, and the composition, associativity of composition is covered in this action. Right? So, as I said, so if you have S small or equal, then you take the classifying category, as it's sometimes called, BS, which has as its objects is S, and if you have X and Y, then the homomorphisms from X to Y, well, and here, see, we want to make these sets disjoint, so I put in the pair X, Y as the only morphism if X is small or equal to Y, and the empty set else. And conversely, and clearly here we have either no or one morphism. And conversely, if you have a category with this property, then you the objects are partially or pre-ordered. By the way, so this gives you, as trivial as it seems, but it gives you sort of the dictionary between combinatorics or certain parts of combinatorics and category theory, something which Giancarlo Rota was the first one to exploit and then was taken up by lots of people like Richard Stanley. Because, jumping way ahead, if you have cohomology theory for categories, so that means by this dictionary you should have cohomology for posets. And then it turns out the Möbius function for posets is nothing else but the old beloved Euler characteristic of the associated categories. So it all flows back together. Okay, so these are the categories with very few morphisms. How about categories with very few objects? So what is a category with one object? What does it mean? Oh, by the way, sorry, before I go there, so you can think about it, but let me mention an example here, which is at the origin of the sort of abstract sheaf theory. If you have X as a topological space, then you define open X to be just the classifying category of the partially ordered set, which is U contained in V, where U and V are open subsets of X. That's the category of open sets underlying a topological space, sort of this very simple construct, but it is sort of the domain of sheaf theory. That's where the sheaves live on. So, now I gave you some breathing room. So what are the categories with just one element? So second example two. So categories with one object. Sorry, one object. What is this? This is, of course, the same thing as an associative monoid, right? You have to have a binary operation. You have to have a left and right-sided identity. And you have to have associativity. So this is the same thing as monoids. And so if you have a monoid M, then you assign to it its classifying category, BM, whose object is just one point, single point, And then you only have to worry about the endomorphisms of this one object, and this is supposed to be your monoid with its given identity and multiplication or composition. Now, here's one example I want just to mention because it appears in various areas, and it has sort of this little tiny feature that the morphism sets are not disjoint, so one needs to be a little bit careful when setting things up. And so here's the typical situation. Let's say you have a G space X. In other words, G is, say, a group. Could be just a monoid, but groups, it's probably more familiar, an X some set. And you have an action. So you have G cross X goes to X, and you require that the usual axioms are satisfied, so that if you take, so you have G comma X maps to G of X, and you want, of course, that the one element in G applied to X just returns X, and you want that G of H of X should be the same as GH of X. Now, when we can construct what is sometimes what's called BG on X, and so the object here is just X itself. So just the points in your set are the objects. And what are the homomorphisms from two such points, between two such points? Well, by definition, this is going what the French have a nice word for it, but I don't think the English have. It's called the transporteur from X to Y. So in other words, you take all the elements G and G such that GX equals Y. Is there an English term for this? Is it transporter from X to Y? And this is, of course, a subset of G. And you see, if you write it like this, then these sets are not necessarily, or usually, they will not be disjoint. Now, you could, of course, adorn them by crossing them with a singleton X and Y just to make them artificially disjoint. But this is a typical situation where everybody would say, yeah, of course. But just something I want to mention. You have to be careful how you think of it. Conversely, and what's the time? May I take a 15-minute break. What I want to show you is that small categories are really nothing but G sets in some way. And that we will make the objects disappear. Not that this is a terribly deep result, but it is sort of the set theoretic analog of Gabriel's structure theorem, which leads to the almost modules, and that's why I thought it would be a neat thing to do it. So, shall we have a 15-minute break? Is that okay? Yeah, you need a monoid.
Otherwise, this is a group void, it's not any category.
Well, the group void is a category, right?
Yeah, but I mean, to get all of them, to get all.
No,
them,
well, I'm coming to this. Yeah, you are right, of course. Yeah, I should have said this is an example of a group void. Oh, thanks. I'll make this remark. Hi.
I have a silly question. I just want to make sure I'm following.
There are no silly questions.
When you talk about disjoint morphisms, you thought you could artificially make it that way.
Yeah, because. No. But just, you see, this is sort of a standard trick. So you replace, say, well, we wrote it like this, CXY. You can always replace it by the set, which is X cross CXY cross. So in other words, you simply add labels to it.
To say this is like the same thing, but with respect to X. Okay.
Yeah, so you see, then even if, say, these two sets were the same. These two sets are not the same. Right? So this is sort of standard procedure. Just add a label to make them artificially distinct. Yeah, sure. of the groupoid, because G is a group, it means that any morphism, and remember, a morphism between two points x, y, and x is just an element G such that y equals gx admits an inverse. Because it's a group, you can go back by G inverse, and so here's a definition. You say that a morphism f from x to y in some category C is an isomorphism if there exists a morphism G from y to x, so in the opposite direction, such that G composed with f is the identity on x, and f composed with g is the identity on y. So in other words, isomorphisms are those morphisms that have inverses, two-sided inverses. And so in the category B XG, every morphism is an isomorphism . Everything has an inverse because G is a group, and such categories are called groupoids. So a G set, if G is a group, that's a special case of a groupoid. And groupoids, by the way, are the crucial ingredients in abstract deformation theory, because that's so that was just a remark. Before I give you the structure theorem for small categories, let me, because I've just started talking about morphisms, let me introduce two more concepts. I mean, whenever you encounter at the beginning algebraic structures, certainly isomorphisms are a crucial class to look at, but you usually also have monomorphisms and epimorphisms as particular classes of maps. So here's a definition. Well, first, to cut our work in half, we'll define what's called the opposite category. So if C is a category, then we define C op, the opposite category, as follows. So we need to say, what are the objects? Well, the objects are the same. We need to say, what are the morphisms? Well, and they are just the opposite. In other words, we declare the morphisms from x to y what used to be the morphisms from y to x. In other words, we read all the arrows backwards. And the third thing is the maps. So, and I'll do it in a diagram. So if we have F is a morphism from x to y, and G is a morphism from y to z. I'm confusing myself. That's not a good idea. So we'll write, how, even though we say that the objects are the same, but we write x op for x considered as an object in C op, just to make things precise. And also, if we have f in from y to x, then under this identification, we denote f op, the corresponding map morphism from x to y in the opposite category. And so, if we then have, say, a morphism in this new category from X to Y, and a morphism from Y to Z, then in reality, of course, this is just a diagram which looks like this. And so, what should be the composition? Of these two, well, there's obviously only one reasonable choice. We define this to be the original composition of F and G, but then considered as a map from X. So here we have F, G, and so in the dual world, that becomes a morphism from X. Yeah, FG up, that becomes this one. And, of course, the identities are the same because identities are uniquely determined. And if you look at the axioms, they are self-dual. If you apply this operator op to it, the equations stay the same, only that left and right get interchanged. And associativity also reads the same in the category and in its opposite. So, that's called the opposite category, and one often says the proof is done by duality, meaning that you get a statement, you prove it, and then you interpret the statement in the opposite category and you get a new statement. And how this works, we'll see here. So here's a definition. A morphism F from X to Y in C is an epimorphism if it has the following property for any morphisms HG from Y to Z, we have that H composed with F equals H composed with G. G composed with F implies H equals G. In other words, F is right cancelable. Right? This is what you have for surjective maps. If two maps become equal after composed with a surjective map, they must be equal. Equivalently, and that's the one I prefer because I don't need to write any equations, for each object Z, the map of sets, namely, HOM C Y Z to HOM C X Z, which is take any morphism from Y to Z and compose it with F, is injective. That's obviously the same statement as the one above. Now, a morphism F is a monomorphism. This is a contrived but still indicative example of this duality business, if and only if the morphism considered in the opposite category, if F op is an epimorphism. Equivalently, and so we'll just write out what it means, It means that F is left countable. So if you have F composed with H equals F composed with G, implies H equals G for all morphisms HG from U to X. Same, again, as in set theory. If you have two maps, you follow them by an injection. If they become equal, then they were already equal before. And so if you retranslate this condition on the Hund sets, the equivalent condition is for all objects G, one has that Hom in C from Z to X to Hom C from Z to Y is injective. Yeah. And so the map here, of course, is this was pre-composition with F, and here it is post-composition with F. So you take something and then apply F to it. Now, for maps, for homomorphisms, for linear maps, you know that a map is an isomorphism if it is a monomorphism and an epimorphism. However, this is no longer true in a general category. So here are three examples, and I give them sort of as an exercise. I want you, doesn't take longer than 30 seconds to see it. So consider the following thing. Consider the category, the classifying category of Z as a monoid. So, under multiplication. So, what are the epis, monos, isos? Remember, so this is just one object and the integers under multiplication act on it. Sort of is the endomorphism set. Okay, that's the first one. The second one is, I claim the following. Let H in G inclusion of a subgroup of order 2 in G, which is S3, so the symmetric group on three letters. I claim this is an epimorphism, is a monomorphism, is an epimorphism, but not an isomorphism in the category of groups. Similar example in the category, let's say, of commutative rings. The inclusion from Z into Q is an epimorphism and mono, but not an iso. So these are the three typical examples showing what goes wrong with the normal notion of epi plus mono equals iso. So perhaps the simplest one is this. So why is the inclusion of two-element subgroup into S3 or D3 or whatever you call it, why is this an epimorphism in the categorical sense? Well, anyone see that? Well, what do we need to see? Well, we have our two-element subgroup, H, which sits inside S3, so mu2, so I'll think of Gua order 2. So what do we have to have? Well, we need to know if we have any homomorphism from G to some other group G prime, or any two, then whenever the restriction to H coincides, they must be the same. And that's what I said. I said this here is an epimorphism. That it is a monomorphism is not difficult. The surprising thing is that it is an epimorphism. Well, I'm just jumping ahead here a little bit. Just think about the case where sort of here we have I, here we have H and G. Just think about the kernels, the possible kernels of H and G. What happens? I mean, a subgroup of order 2 in S3 is not normal. But the kernel of any group homomorphism is a normal subgroup. So if you were to compare H with a trivial homomorphism, and if this morphism has H in the kernel, well, then it must have the whole group in the kernel. In other words, any homomorphism that restricted to H is trivial must be trivial. In other words, what is sort of the proper image of H and G? It's not H. It's the normalizer of H and G. So, for group homomorphism, so this is a lemma which I leave to you to prove. If you have phi from H to G, a group homomorphism, then phi is an epi in the category of groups if and only if the normalizer in G of phi of H is all of G. Now here's clearly the sort of corollary of this is that any surjective group homomorphism is an epi. But not the other way around. However, it is true, as an exercise, that group, so mono, well, I'm write it, monomorphisms in the category of groups is the same thing as injective group homomorphisms. So it's only for the, sort of on the epi side where you have a distinction, not on the mono side.